I want you to imagine that you are at a house party.
Okay.
It's getting late, the vibe in the living room is just right, and someone picks up an acoustic guitar.
We've all been to that party.
Right. And they start playing, and they absolutely kill it. The small crowd is totally engaged. The acoustics in that tiny room are, surprisingly good.
Yeah.
And for 10 minutes, this person seems like an absolute superstar.
Right, they own the room.
Exactly. But I want you to consider a completely different scenario with that exact same musician.
Yeah.
Take them in that moment and drop them onto the main stage at a massive outdoor music festival at 3 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
The wind is howling, the monitors are broken, and the crowd is incredibly unpredictable. Would they survive that set?
I mean, almost certainly not.
Right.
The gap between a highly controlled environment where everyone wants you to succeed and just the sheer hostility of a live, unscripted arena, it's massive.
The raw talent might be there, sure. But when the audience at 3 a.m. decides to start throwing bottles or the power cuts out.
The guitar skills don't matter anymore.
Exactly. It becomes an exercise in survival. And that dynamic, that tension, is the core of what we are exploring for you in today's deep dive.
It's a really great analogy for software development, actually.
It really is. We have our hands on a fascinating set of developer logs detailing the creation of an AI companion named Mio.
Which is super cool.
Yeah. Specifically, we are examining the raw notes from a very specific update, which is called V0.0.3.
And I have to say, these logs are incredibly rare.
They really are.
Normally, developers publish these shiny blog posts about their big breakthroughs or brand new features.
Right, all the glamorous stuff.
Exactly. This document is the exact opposite of that. It's an honest, really gritty look at the invisible work that keeps a system from collapsing.
And that's our mission for this deep dive,
Yeah.
to uncover that deeply unglamorous work required to bridge the gap we just talked about.
Right.
We want to show you how a developer takes a really cool, functional software demo
Oh.
and transforms it into a reliable, production-ready product
Something that real humans can actually interact with.
without breaking it into a million pieces. Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly understand how apps are built to survive the wild, we have to start with the most visible vulnerability in any system,
The human element.
the human element. Specifically, how users input their own data.
Yeah. If you give a human being a blank text box, you are basically inviting absolute chaos into your database.
It's so true. I was reading through the notes on the previous version of this AI, V.0.2,
Right.
and the developer made a decision that just seems wild in retrospect. They set a 500-character limit for every single custom input during the user onboarding phase.
Which is just a massive amount of space.
It's huge. If the app asked for your nickname, you had 500 characters. Hobbies, 500 characters.
Yeah.
To me, that is like handing a complete stranger a blank check and just, crossing your fingers that they only write down a dollar.
A user could literally write a short novel in the nickname field. And the system was so permissive that it also silently accepted completely blank inputs.
Wow.
Yeah, a user
Gosh.
could just hit submit on every single field without typing a single letter, and the AI would just shrug and move forward.
Wait, I have to push back on this though.
Okay.
Why do developers get this so wrong in the first place? I mean, it feels obvious that a human being's first name shouldn't be 500 characters long.
You'd think so, yeah.
Shouldn't an engineer just know to cap that at something reasonable from day one?
Well, this raises an important question about how software is actually born.
Okay.
When a developer is building a demo in isolation, they are usually testing it themselves. They type in Dave, they hit enter, and the system works.
Right, they aren't trying to break it.
Exactly. They aren't trying to break their own creation. So the 500-character limit wasn't a deliberate engineering choice. It was just a lazy placeholder.
Oh, that makes sense.
The real education only happens when you expose the product to actual users. And fixing it took several iterations.
Yeah, the logs mentioned dropping the name limit down to 50 characters first.
Which still proved to be entirely too long.
Because who has a 50-character first name?
Exactly. User feedback came back immediately pointing that out. So the developer adjusted again, bringing it down to 10 characters.
But Mio's deployed globally, right?
Right. And the international feedback revealed a brand new blind spot. 10 Chinese characters is still excessively long for a name.
Oh, because Chinese names are typically only 2 to 4 characters.
Exactly. So they had to fail 3 times to find the sweet spot. They finally settled on a 6-character maximum for names.
And then they restricted the style input to 30 characters, hobbies to 50, and only kept that massive 500-character limit for the user's backstory.
It is a perfect example of how you cannot guess human behavior in a vacuum. You have to learn it from the users.
Speaking of human behavior, I found the shift in how they handled those hobbies really revealing.
Oh, the multi-select toggle.
Yes. In the older version, the hobby selection was just a single-choice drop-down menu. You tell the app you like movies, and that's it.
Right. You can't also like running.
Exactly. But in V0.0.3, they changed that input to a multi-select toggle.
And, I mean, changing a drop-down menu to a toggle sounds like the most boring technical update imaginable.
It really does.
But the developer realized it completely alters the psychological weight of the onboarding process.
Oh, so?
Forcing a user to pick one single interest makes them feel like they are filling out a rigid tax form.
Oh, I hate that feeling.
Right. But allowing them to tap multiple toggles changes the feeling of the entire interaction. It shifts it to expressing yourself.
That's fascinating. Those subtle psychological nudges are just everywhere in this log. Which actually brings us to the quiet hours feature.
Yes, this is a great one.
The older version of Mio was programmed with a default setting, right? The AI would automatically silence any proactive messages between 11 at night and 8 in the morning.
Yeah, that was the default.
And on paper, I completely agree with that. Nobody wants an AI pinging their phone at 2 in the morning.
But the reality is the users absolutely did want that.
Really?
Yes. The developer was flooded with feedback from users complaining that the AI was ignoring them at night.
That completely flipped my perspective on how people use these companions.
Well, think about it. Many users of these AI platforms are night owls.
True.
Or they live in completely different time zones than the developer. The developer coined a brilliant term for this, actually. Product manager arrogance.
Let's linger on that for a second. Because product manager arrogance feels like a concept that applies to almost all the technology we use.
It absolutely does. It is the trap of making default assumptions about a user's life based entirely on the creator's life.
Wow, so the developer assumed that because they sleep at midnight, everyone sleeps at midnight.
Exactly. Every default setting in a piece of technology reveals the invisible biases of the person who coded it.
That is so true.
So the fix here was to make quiet hours opt-in. The baseline state is unrestricted messaging. You don't make lifestyle decisions for your users.
You give them the tools to set their own boundaries.
Precisely.
Okay, so we have established how to handle the human inputs and boundaries. But a relationship is a two-way street.
It is.
If you fix how the user speaks to the AI, you are forced to address how the AI speaks back. If the AI initiates a conversation and sounds like a generic robot,
the illusion of companionship instantly shatters.
Instantly.
Yeah, you are moving from the mechanics of user interface design into the complex territory of an empathy algorithm.
And the V0.0.2 system had a proactive feature called a heartbeat, right?
Yeah.
Where Mio would randomly ping you to check in.
Right. But the problem was that this heartbeat was entirely blind.
What do you mean by blind?
You could spend 3 hours having a deeply emotional conversation about your career stress on Tuesday night. And on Wednesday morning, Mio would cheerfully text you, "Hey, it's been a while. How was your day?"
Oh, yikes. Yeah, that destroys the immersion completely.
Completely.
It is exactly like having a friend who texts you out of the blue, but their message makes it painfully obvious they weren't listening to a single word you said the day before.
Right.
It makes the user feel totally unseen.
And what's fascinating here is the technical leap they made in V0.0.3 to fix this, and, well, the harsh economic reality that governed that fix.
Okay, tell me about the fix first.
They implemented a context-aware heartbeat. Now, before the AI initiates any contact, it silently works in the background. It loads the last 5 messages of your conversation history.
Okay.
It pulls your specific user profile, and it checks your display name.
So it actually reads the room, reviews its notes on you, and then formulates an opening line.
Exactly. Instead of a generic greeting, it asks how that stressful work presentation went.
Wow. The developer notes that the fundamental difference between a chatbot and a friend is memory. Friends remember what you said.
They do. But building that memory mechanism is where the economics get really tricky.
I looked at the developer's tiering system for API costs, and it is a masterclass in budgeting.
Budgeting is the silent killer of AI startups.
Right, because querying a standard database is cheap, If an app just pulls a pre-written template greeting from a server, it costs fractions of a cent. It takes milliseconds.
Yeah, basically free.
But Mio's using large language models. To send a context-aware message, the system has to load a massive neural network into GPU memory.
Right.
It has to feed it your conversation history as tokens and compute a probabilistically unique response. That uses immense compute power.
And compute power costs real money.
Exactly. So the developer categorized their users. If you are a cold user, someone who downloaded the app, poked around for 5 minutes, and hasn't opened it in 3 weeks.
You do not get the expensive LLM messages.
Right. You get the free generic templates.
Because you simply cannot justify spending real API dollars generating a deeply personalized, empathetic message for a user who is almost certainly just going to swipe the notification away without reading it.
That makes total business sense.
Right. Only the active, warm, or cool users trigger the expensive generation process. It is the economic reality of simulated empathy.
Empathy is literally gated by your activity level.
It is.
It sounds incredibly ruthless when we lay it out like that, but from an engineering standpoint, it is the only way the business survives.
Yeah, you have to protect the budget.
They also leaned into making those early interactions count by introducing distinct backstories.
Oh, this was clever.
Yeah. Depending on whether you set the AI as a friend, a romantic partner, or a confidant, the AI uses entirely different opening narratives.
Because the developer realized that the very first message dictates whether a user feels understood enough to stick around.
Which goes to show that in software, the first impression isn't just about pretty graphics.
No, it's about establishing the correct narrative context immediately.
Okay, so the UI is tightened up, the AI is acting human, and the API budget is protected from inactive users.
So far, so good.
But even if the user and the AI are behaving perfectly, the system can still collapse if the underlying servers have a miscommunication.
Oh, yeah.
We need to leave the user experience entirely now and travel down to the raw server infrastructure, into the hostile wild of production.
This is where the developer logs shift from psychology to pure, unforgiving computer science.
The developer highlighted what they considered the most exciting bug of the entire update. And it centers on how the app listens for new messages. So let me break down the two methods they use, because the disconnect between them is the root of the problem.
Go for it.
When the developer is coding on their laptop, Mio uses polling mode. Polling is basically like a kid in the backseat of a car constantly asking, are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Right. The app is constantly asking the server if there are new messages.
Exactly.
It is active, continuous checking.
But when the app goes live on the cloud, it uses webhook mode. A webhook is like the parent in the front seat saying, stop asking. I will tell you the exact moment we get there. The server automatically pushes the message to the app the second it arrives.
Much more efficient for production.
Yes. Yeah. But in the code, the developer wrote a seemingly innocent command. When the application receives a shutdown signal, which is known as a SIG term, it should delete the webhook and clean up its connection.
Which is incredibly responsible behavior when you are coding locally on a laptop.
Right.
When you shut your testing environment down, you want it to clean up the connections so everything is fresh the next time you boot up.
But here's where it gets really interesting. If that code works flawlessly on the developer's laptop, why did it cause a catastrophic failure when deployed to the cloud? The logic seems perfectly sound.
Well, because the cloud environment in this case, Google Cloud Run, manages power cycles completely differently than a laptop.
How so?
On a laptop, you only shut down when you are done working. But in Cloud Run, that shutdown signal, the SIG term, is fired every single time the developer deploys a new version of the app. Yeah. The cloud infrastructure says, I see an update. I am going to spin up the new container and send a SIG term to the old container to shut it down.
Okay, I see where this is going.
The old container behaves perfectly. It receives the shutdown signal, and it dutifully deletes the webhook. But the new container hasn't completely finished booting up yet.
There's a gap.
Exactly. There is a microscopic gap in time. The webhook is gone, but the new version isn't awake to register a new one.
So during that tiny gap, Mio goes completely deaf.
Yes.
Any user who happens to send a message in that exact window has their text vanish into the void. The app doesn't crash. It just drops the conversation. That is incredibly frustrating for the user.
And the cruelest part of this bug is that it is fundamentally impossible to reproduce on a local laptop.
Because local development uses polling.
Exactly. It doesn't even interact with webhooks.
Yeah.
A developer could test that code for 1,000 hours on their machine and never see the failure. It only exists in the hostile wild of deployment. The fix was just adding a single line of logic to only delete the webhook if the system was in polling mode. But diagnosing that gap probably required hours of forensics.
It is the absolute peak of the "but it worked on my machine" meme.
It really is.
And the deployment environment presented another major threat, which was media rate limiting.
Yes, this is crucial.
Mio is capable of transcribing user voice messages and analyzing images. Both of those actions require highly complex, very expensive API calls.
Right.
If a malicious script, or even just a glitching cell phone, sends 100 voice messages in 60 seconds, the API budget is instantly drained.
Gone in a minute.
Like, the developer implemented an in-memory sliding window rate limiter, capping users at 10 media requests per 60 seconds.
And the mechanism of a sliding window is brilliant here.
Let's explain why a sliding window is necessary over a simple fixed timer. If I set a fixed limit of 10 messages per minute and it resets at the top of every minute, I could theoretically send 10 messages at 1.59. At 2.0, the counter resets, and I immediately send 10 more messages at 2.01. I just hit the server with 20 heavy media requests in the span of 2 seconds, entirely legally within the rules.
And a sliding window prevents exactly that loophole.
How does it do that?
It doesn't reset at the top of the minute. It constantly looks backward exactly 60 seconds from the current timestamp. It is a continuous rolling barrier.
That is smart. And the developer made the conscious choice to build this directly into the app's memory rather than using a complex external database like Redis.
Yes, they did.
But I have to challenge that decision, actually. There is a deeply ingrained philosophy in software engineering that premature optimization is a cardinal sin.
That's true. You hear that a lot.
You shouldn't build complex infrastructure for millions of users when you only have 50. Doesn't building a custom sliding window rate limiter before the app even have a massive user base violate that rule?
It is a delicate balance, but the developer makes a compelling argument here. Having zero rate limiting is a far more dangerous evil than premature optimization.
Why is that?
Because you aren't building a sliding window because you distrust your users, you are building it because the internet is chaotic.
Right.
A bad network connection in a subway tunnel might cause a user's phone to retry sending the same voice memo 40 times.
Oh, that makes sense.
A rate limiter isn't an optimization. It is the absolute last line of defense between the developer's bank account and an unpredictable reality.
Which begs the ultimate question. If a developer is managing rolling window calculations, LLM context loading, and cloud deployment bugs, how do they survive?
Good question.
How do they add all these complex features without the sheer cognitive load causing them to accidentally break the whole system? They need a safety net.
And in the architecture of software, that safety net is automated testing.
The developer's log reveals they added 144 brand new automated tests in this update alone. They built tests for the chat flows, the onboarding sequences, and the new media modules.
It brought the total code base to nearly 400 separate tests.
So what does this all mean for the developer's workflow? I think about it like a trapeze artist at the circus.
Oh, I like this.
The audience assumes the safety net is strung up just in case the performer makes a mistake and falls.
Right, as a backup.
But the reality is that the safety net is what mentally liberates the trapeze artist to attempt a triple backflip in the first place, without the paralyzing fear of death.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that psychological liberation is exactly what the developer is describing.
Yeah.
There is a counterintuitive truth, and engineering test coverage and development speed are positively correlated.
Which defies common sense, because writing 144 tests takes hours of extra coding. It seems like it would slow everything down.
Without a robust test suite, a developer has to rely on their own working memory. Every time they alter a single line of code, they have to mentally simulate the entire state of the application to ask themselves, did changing this webhook logic just break the user onboarding?
And human working memory simply cannot hold that many variables.
The cognitive overhead is crushing. But with 400 automated tests, the developer makes their change, runs the suite, and if the indicators glow green, they deploy. It entirely eliminates the fear of regression.
The developer also engaged in a massive code audit. They utilized an AI review agent to scan the entire code base for warnings, deployed a fix agent to resolve those issues, and repeated that loop continuously until the code was totally clean.
They were very thorough.
And they didn't just target the critical red alert bugs, they resolved the minor severity warnings too.
Because technical debt always accrues interest.
That's a great way to put it.
That minor low-priority warning that you casually ignore on a Tuesday afternoon is precisely the vulnerability that will compound and crash your cloud server at 3 a.m. on a Saturday.
The commitment to future-proofing extended all the way to the business model, too.
Yeah.
The developer included a document in the repository called monetization.md. Inside, they mapped out an elaborate 5-tier subscription plan: free, basic, pro, premium, and an ultimate tier. But Mio is totally free right now. There's no billing system built, and there are zero paying users.
Yeah, it seems a bit early for that.
I initially wondered why they would waste time mapping out subscription tiers for a free platform.
Because the destination dictates the roads you must build today.
Exactly. If you don't build the architectural hooks to count a user's messages today, every function you write assumes infinite, unrestricted usage.
Right.
Retrofitting a system later to suddenly restrict access is an absolute nightmare.
It creates immense architectural gravity. Planning for the fact that you will eventually need to gate certain features behind a paywall fundamentally changes how you write the foundational database schemas right now.
It has to be in the foundation.
Retrofitting those changes later is always exponentially more expensive and painful.
Looking at everything we've analyzed for you today, from the iterations on character limits and the rolling math of sliding windows, to the economic gating of AI empathy and the psychological safety nets of testing the core thesis of this developer's journey, is profound.
It really is.
Truly excellent infrastructure is entirely invisible.
The better the engineering, the less the user notices it.
Nobody writes a 5-star review celebrating a well-implemented webhook protocol.
Never.
Users do not notice seamless input validation. They simply take it for granted. Nobody throws a parade for an in-memory rate limiter. They just drain your budget if you forget to build one.
Exactly.
This V.0.3 update did not add any flashy, marketable new tricks to the AI, but it took a project that merely felt alive in a demo and transformed it into a system that is actually resilient.
It marks the critical transition from a fragile personal experiment to a hardened, real-world product.
And the logs even tease the roadmap for V.0.0.4. Now that this invisible foundation is solid, they're looking at introducing voice replies, expanding multi-turn memory, and actually implementing the billing system they plan for.
But none of that could happen without surviving V0.0.3 first.
Exactly right.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Please do.
The next time you open up your phone and interact with an app that feels completely flawless, where the interface is frictionless, it anticipates your needs, and it never crashes under load, I want you to bring this deep dive to mind.
Right.
Ask yourself, how many invisible layers of problem solving, how many patched vulnerabilities, and how many quiet safety nets are you actually interacting with in that exact millisecond?
You are never just looking at a performer easily commanding a festival stage. You are looking at the hundreds of grueling, unglamorous hours they spent rehearsing in a living room, engineering exactly how to survive when the environment turns hostile.